KTD News. I'm Dave McGrath. It's 10 past 8. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're going to be having a wonderful time, I think, over the next few minutes talking about a fascinating new book called Enough is Enough. I wish that this were video rather than just the audio world of radio, because if you were looking at the cover of this book, you would see at the top of the title page, Enough, spelled as we typically do, Enough is, but then three different versions of the word enough crossed out, each spelled in a little different way. Finally, settling on the simplest version of all, Enough, E-N-U-F. And so thus the title is Enough is Enough, our failed attempts to make English easier to spell. And in this book, author Gabe Henry has chronicled what in fact is a fascinating and quite extensive history of various reformers' attempts to simplify and standardize the way English is spoken. And of course, for any of us who have grappled with the English language, and in particular grappled with the matter of correct or incorrect spelling, we all know that the language of English is a particularly unruly one. And so it is something with which a whole lot of people have contended. And most of us just sort of accept this as a point of fact, when in fact there have been all kinds of people through history, some of them famous, some of them largely unknown and forgotten, who have really worked to try to make the English language and its spelling a bit less absurd or problematic. And Gabe Henry, in his fascinating new book, has explored this history and also taken some time to talk about why the English language is the way it is. And that historical context is very valuable in understanding everything else that that ensues. Perhaps you have heard of his previous book, Eating Salad Drunk, in which he collaborated with some major forces of comedy in our country, including Jerry Seinfeld, Roy Wood Jr., and others. He has explored this history of so-called simplified spelling for nearly a decade. And so this book, while a great deal of fun, is one that has been methodically researched and very carefully and entertainingly written. It is published by Day Street, an imprint of William Morrow. Again, it's titled Enough is Enough, Our Failed Attempts to Make English Easier to Spell. And Gabe Henry, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Hi, Gregory. Nice to be here.
So if you would, tell us, first of all, what initially drew you to this intriguing topic, which apparently has been a source of fascination for you for some time now. Did anything in particular bring this across your bow, so to speak?
Well, you know, as you mentioned, I've always grappled with English spelling, and I'm what I would consider a good speller. So I think that there's a problem there if even the best spellers in a language are still struggling with it. Other languages don't necessarily have this. And you use the word unruly to describe English. I would also throw in the word clumsy, difficult, maybe dumb. It's, you know, our language is full of silent letters and contradictory rules. We have words like through and though and tough, cough, which all look similar on paper, but really sound nothing alike. So this book is about the simplified spelling movement, which was this underground campaign over hundreds of years to try to fix our spelling, to shorten it, to streamline it. For instance, spelling laugh, L-A-F, or love, L-U-V. And this movement attracted so many historical figures, people like Noah Webster, Benjamin Franklin, Mark Twain, even Charles Darwin, and a whole host of eccentric reformers that no one has ever heard of. So I really wanted to bring this movement to life and to shine a light on these reformers and to show that, you know, sometimes these efforts to reform society, sometimes they don't work in the moment. Sometimes they fail. But over time, sometimes you see that their efforts have these ripple effects throughout history.
Well, and it's also really interesting to think about when a reform effort works, when it achieves success, or when it doesn't, when it fails. And of course, generally speaking, these efforts to simplify the English language and to make it more, in a sense, sensible and law-abiding have pretty much all failed to varying degrees. Or is that too sweeping a statement? I mean, can we point to certain efforts that actually have borne some kind of fruit, even if the English language still remains largely what it is?
That's an appropriate level of sweeping statement, I would say. Maybe 99% of these efforts failed. In essence, this book is kind of a biography of failure. It's a biography of futility. It's a biography of hard-headed, narrow-minded, but high-minded reformers who really have this idea for a utopian society. And this took the form of changing the language and shortening it. And obviously, if you look around today in our formal writing, we don't have many of these simplified spellings. We don't spell tongue, T-U-N-G. But there were some simplifications that did catch on. Noah Webster, in the 1820s, he wrote Webster's Dictionary. And in this dictionary, he was able to selectively incorporate some of his older simplified spelling proposals, words like color spelled without the U, and theater ending in E-R rather than R-E. So there are some downstream effects of this movement that we still have today.
Well, and of course, your book actually early on touches on something with us today, namely this digital world in which we are all texting. And I think at one point you say something about this digital age pushing all of us towards simplification and abridgment. I mean, it's a technology that neither Benjamin Franklin nor Noah Webster could have possibly envisioned or imagined. And yet, in some respects, it seems like this technology is nudging us towards this goal in a way that maybe nothing else ever has before.
I think that language tends to reflect the pace of the society we live in. And for hundreds of years, we have been using the same language, the same spelling. And there is something unique to English in that it is quite inefficient and quite inconsistent. So here we are in the digital age, and we're texting each other and emailing each other at the speed of light. And our spelling seems to be adapting to our new faster-paced interconnectedness. So if the primary intent of communication is to get information across as quickly as possible and as clearly as possible, then it seems natural that this new informal way of communicating with our thumbs is selecting for this shorter route between two people. I think that's what we're seeing now. It's kind of this irony that for hundreds of years, the simplified spelling movement tried to push these words like through, spelled T-H-R-U, and though, T-H-O, and to little success. And here we are, and we're seeing the language organically simplifying in this way that people tried for so long.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking today with Gabe Henry about his latest book, which is called Enough is Enough: Our Failed Attempts to Make English Easier to Spell. And again, I wish you could see the cover of the book, because the first enough is spelled E-N-O-U-G-H. The second enough is spelled E-N-U-F, the way that a simplified speller would want to spell that particular word. And the book, although we have been touching on present-day America, is a book of history, and in particular tells the story of what Gabe Henry at one point calls the rebel wordsmiths, who worked energetically to try and simplify the spelling of the English language. Maybe one thing we should talk about as we kind of look at the oldest history of all of this is that the English language is not, of course, unique to America. It didn't begin here at all. And your book does take some time to talk about matters related to British English, where, of course, it all began. Is this whole matter of trying to simplify the language, is that more of an American phenomenon than a British phenomenon? Or throughout British history, have we seen a lot of the same kind of energy around this particular issue?
We saw a lot of this this energy on both sides of the Atlantic in the 1800s. But the first spark of this movement was in the 1780s with Noah Webster, who is, we all know him as the creator of Webster's Dictionary, the father of American English. And in 1789, he was trying to figure out a way to distinguish America from England. So here we are after the American Revolution. And the question is, how are we as Americans going to differentiate ourselves from our former oppressor? How are we going to distinguish ourselves politically, culturally, and linguistically? So Webster's idea was that we would continue speaking in English, but we would spell in American English. And American English would be more logical, it would be more phonetic, more consistent. Enough would be E-N-U-F. Ake would be A-K-E. And so this came out of this political patriotic drive to make America its own linguistic identifying country rather than speaking and writing the language of its oppressor.
Let's turn the clock back, and I'm so glad that you do this in your book, back to the earliest roots of the English language, because that helps to answer the question you pose very early on, namely, how did English spelling become so very, very complicated? And of course, it has so much to do with the very nature of how the language of English first emerged, in a sense, not as a single cohesive language at all. Tell our listeners about the Celts and the nature of this Celtic language, which is, of course, the ultimate source material for so much of our language, but the kind of the unique character of it that really helps explain all that unfolded thereafter.
Right. To understand why English spelling is so poor right now, you have to really look at its history, and a lot has to do with England's geography and its vulnerability to invasion. And for hundreds of years, it was pummeled by the Vikings, the Romans, the Germans, the French, and the communities that were originally on the island of England were the Celts. This was in the BC era, and they were a group of decentralized tribes, and they all spoke decentralized languages that we refer to collectively as Celtic, but it was really many different strands of dialects. And when the Romans invaded England, the Romans pushed all these Celtic tribes into the outer periphery of England, into the outer isles, places like Ireland and Scotland and Wales, and eventually those Celtic languages turned into the Gaelics, the Gaelic and the Welsh that we know today. And in that void of left by the Celts, the Romans brought Latin with them. So Latin for several hundred years became the primary language of England. The Roman Empire fell, and then in comes the Germans. The Germans eventually give way to the Vikings, who spoke Old Norse, and then eventually to the French. And over millennia, all these different languages merged and mingled and mixed, and they turned into this messy hodgepodge that we know today as English.
I don't know if you ever use this term in your book, but I've certainly heard the English language described as a mutt, M-U-T-T. And I think your book does as good a job as I have ever seen of sort of explaining in fairly succinct fashion that complicated history of how it came to be the sort of language that it is. In this chapter, taking the long historic view, you talk at one point about something that I don't remember ever hearing anything about, something called the Great Vowel Shift. And this was apparently something that, in a sense, opened up a rift between how we spoke English and how we wrote English. What was this Great Vowel Shift?
This was a period about 300 years roughly from 1400s to the 1700s. And this was a organic, unconscious shift in how we pronounced words in English. Different regions shifted in different ways, but in general, what was happening during this shift is that while our spelling went in one direction, our pronunciations went in another. And they might have, these two lines might have stayed parallel if it weren't for the advent of the printing press. So in the 1400s, printing press is introduced to England, and that kind of solidifies and crystallizes our English spelling where it is. So English spelling becomes fossilized in that moment, while our pronunciations continue to shift. A lot of the clumsiness of English today are the difference in spelling versus pronunciation has to do with that, those lines going in different directions, and that great great vowel shift is a big part of that.
Mm. Yeah, that was a fascinating story you tell us about one William Caxton, who essentially brought the printing press, a German invention, to England, and he ends up, in a sense, solidifying the English language at this time when it was, as you just were explaining, in this state of flux. I think my favorite aspect of this story, which, again, I knew nothing about before reading your book, Enough is Enough, was the whole matter of straight margins. And this was something that I suppose a lot of champions of the early printing press loved, that look of stark, straight margins. And what had been done with Mr. Gutenberg and others was the utilization of hyphens. But Caxton's solution for achieving straight margins was very, very different, and a sort of telling example of kind of what we're talking about. Would you mind explaining to our listeners what I'm talking about?
Well, Caxton, being that he was England's first printer, he had a lot of influence on the future of the language. And I don't know if he knew at the time how much influence it was going to be. But he had this tendency to fiddle with his spellings for the purpose of fitting his lines neatly in these straight margins. So if you read a book today, you'll see that the margins on the left-hand side of the text and the right-hand side go straight, justified, and they're, when you look at them and you squint, you see a square block of text. This was an aesthetic attribute that William Caxton liked just as much as we do. But he didn't have the access to word documents and spacing and all the techniques we have today to fit those lines into square margins. So he would either add letters or subtract letters in this effort to get a line straight with the right-hand side. So he, if you look through his books, you'll see there are versions of words like pity, spelled P-I-T-Y, P-I-T-T-Y, P-I-T-T-Y-E. And this was all in this, for this purpose of making his interior pages look aesthetically perfect to him. And he also had this opportunity to use hyphens to cut a word in half and bring the second half down to the next line, which Gutenberg used and many other printers used. But for whatever reason, Caxton didn't use it. Maybe he didn't like it. And again, his favorite technique of reaching that right-hand margin was fiddling with his spellings.
You do talk about a few other British reformers as well. We don't have time to explore them all. We leave that to our listeners to explore them in greater detail. But I do want to give you a chance to talk for a moment about one Englishman who you tell us was a tutor to the 12-year-old King of England, Edward VI. And he was someone who championed a simplification of English spelling. And you call him at one point something of a linguistic patriot because of what was sort of spurring him on in his efforts. Tell our listeners about this intriguing Englishman.
This is in the late 1500s. This is a man named John Cheek. And he was in the, I mean, he was not royalty, but he was close to it. He was a tutor to the future king. And his main issue with our spelling was the existence of silent consonants. So words like subtle with a B and debt with a B, receipt with a P. And these letters were, they came into our language only about a century earlier because of this attempt to Latinize English. There was this big effort to turn English into Latin because Latin was this language that everyone grew up learning. It was old, it was classical, and English was this new, clumsy, messy language. So in an effort to make English more like Latin, some scribes and monks would insert these silent consonants. So det, D-E-T, inherited a B, because in Latin the word is debitum, which is the same root as the word debit card. And John Cheek was this linguistic patriot in that he wanted English to be English. He didn't want English to be Latin. So he embarked on this effort to, in a way, simplify English by removing these silent letters, by re-anglicizing it. And despite his best efforts, just like everyone else in this book, he failed pretty hard and no one took him seriously. He published a couple books, but these books were, the people who had access to them had no position, no authority to mandate these spellings anywhere. And they kind of faded away, just like all these others.
I love the phrase that either you use or someone else in describing his work as creating a spelling that would be pure and unmangled by foreign influence. And, of course, that foreign influence being Latin. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Gabe Henry about his endlessly fascinating new book called Enough is Enough, Our Failed Attempts to Make English Easier to Spell. And of course, this story becomes, I dare say, even more interesting for the typical American reader when indeed you take this issue across the Atlantic to the New World, so to speak, and talk about how the colonists, it's, you give us the impression of it being fairly quickly, began speaking, in your words, a fully distinct American English dialect. What would be a couple of the most noteworthy ways in which so-called American English was quite distinct from English, if you will? And how did those changes most commonly emerge?
Well, the first changes that someone would have noticed was a change in accent, change in dialect. But then when you look at the vocabulary of American English, you'll see that it starts to merge very quickly with certain Native American words, words like bluff to refer to a cliff, canoe, maze. These are all words that, or moccasin, these are all words that came from Native Americans. And the British, when they received letters or saw the writing of Americans and they were using these words, they called it a bastardized English. They called it dumb. And throughout this book, there's this constant theme of linguistic elitism, linguistic supremacy. My version of English is better than yours. My version of reform is better than yours. So American English was very early looked upon as a dumber version of English. I know many English people today would still think that, but it maybe not so much if they realize how old that cliche is of the new language emerging, the language emerging on a new continent and changing and morphing with the landscape and the terrain. Hmm.
I appreciate the time you take to talk about a British man by the name of Samuel Johnson. You call him the quintessential linguistic conservative. He loved his language as much as he hated its transatlantic cousin. And, of course, his means to try to preserve the beauty of the English language as he saw it was to construct what, from the sounds of it, was an enormous dictionary like the world had never seen. I mean, there had been English language dictionaries before. What made his so different and distinct?
The size, the thoroughness. Dictionaries before were pretty sparse, pretty scant, and Samuel Johnson created a two-volume dictionary that weighed about 20 pounds, and he created it in this effort to distinguish true British English from this bastardized American English. So he wanted to reclaim the language for his country, and he wanted to create an authoritative book that for now and forevermore would be the go-to definitive place for people to learn the language. He wanted that language to be British English, and he wanted it to be spread around the world. So that this was his way of pushing the British version above the American version. Again, this supremacist idea of my language is better than yours.
Right, and you tell us that two-volume dictionary weighed about the same as an automobile tire. So it was a formidable book in more ways than one. But of course, it was all for naught in terms of winning this cultural battle that he thought was so important. Well, this brings us, of course, to one of the most intriguing figures in your book, and this would be probably among the most familiar names in your book, and that would be, of course, the beloved American Benjamin Franklin. But I dare say that even for most of us who pride ourselves in knowing something about Benjamin Franklin, I would venture to say that very few of us, certainly me, have known nothing about this particular facet of Benjamin Franklin, that is, his fascination with this notion of simplified spelling. Tell us what you think is most important for us to know about this facet of Benjamin Franklin and the way in which this folds into the rest of his quite familiar persona.
Well, of course, we know Franklin as an inventor, and we know him for a lot of tangible inventions, the bifocals and certain this extendable arm, and we know a lot of his physical objects, but his linguistic invention, the simplified spelling version that he came up with in 1768, few people know about. So in 1768, he comes up with this system that he calls a new alphabet and a reformed mode of spelling. And in this new spelling system, he eliminates six letters from the alphabet, and he adds six new letters to the alphabet, and he respells words like you as I-U, and the word could spells with a K. And he shared this system with only one person, his friend Polly Stevenson, and he sent her a letter with this essay asking her for advice on how to improve it, and she was so unenthused by this whole system and could barely read it that Franklin really never spoke about it publicly again until a couple decades later, until Noah Webster came along.
You described the scene really, really well. This is 1786. By this point, Benjamin Franklin is 80 years old and among the most famous of all Americans. And you describe a scene in which Benjamin Franklin hears a kind of a young whippersnapper by the name of Noah Webster speaking. Describe what this occasion was and what Noah Webster was saying on this occasion.
So this is 1786, Noah Webster. He's about 27 years old. No one knows his name yet. He has this unruly orange hair, and he talks in this high pitch, and no one is taking him and his thoughts seriously. But on this tour, he's going around America, and he's talking about simplified spelling, a new way of spelling words phonetically. And Franklin comes to one of his lectures in Philadelphia, and he realizes that Webster is espousing a lot of the same sentiments that Franklin himself came up with 20 years earlier. So the two start talking. The two make some tentative plans to collaborate on a new spelling that they would jointly share to the powers that be and try to make it the law of the land. Noah Webster has a very big ego, and even Franklin is not enough to overshadow it. So Webster kind of cuts Franklin out and goes his own direction with this. And the collaboration never really materialized. So Webster instead pushes forth with his own radical spelling reform. And in 1789, he publishes this essay that is, he's trying to blow the door wide open. And what happens instead is that there's all this blowback, all this pushback. His reforms are too radical, and there's just too much mockery for him to get it through. So he kind of pulls back his spelling reform ideas at that time.
It's so interesting. I mean, one of the things you tell us about this tentative partnership between Noah Webster and Ben Franklin is that at the heart of Ben Franklin's efforts was the invention of a new alphabet, in effect. And you tell us that was of no interest to Noah Webster. He didn't want to reinvent the alphabet. He just wanted to change spelling. So in a sense, he saw his path forward, I suppose, is in some ways less radical than Benjamin Franklin's. And yet, as you tell us, the backlash was swift and brutal. And of course, a lot of these folks who have tried to get our spelling simplified have kind of faced the same kind of thing. Give us an idea of the nature of that backlash. I mean, why were people so adamant in their rejection of what Noah Webster was suggesting?
Well, to start with, I think visually, aesthetically, simplified spelling looks pretty silly. I think this is going to be everyone's first impression of it, and this was my first impression, seeing the word love spelled L-U-V. It either looks like a teenager texting to their friends or a six-year-old learning how to spell and trying to sound it out. It definitely doesn't look like a language authority spelling in this intellectual way. So there was this initial instinct to mock it immediately, to ridicule it. And we saw it in 1789, and then we've seen it ever since. And I think that another reason, not just the inherent humor of it, but their language is deeply rooted in tradition, and it's deeply rooted in identity, and those are two things that people really don't like changing. Language might organically morph over time, but we're not old. We don't live long enough to see most of those take place. And if we did, we would probably rebel against it. We would probably put up some kind of resistance because we don't like those things changing that are so tied to who we are and where we come from.
The story of Noah Webster and his quest for simplifying American spelling ends in really interesting fashion. And of course, most of us now know the name Noah Webster for his incredibly famous dictionary. Again, not the first American dictionary, but a dictionary better than any that had appeared before. And you kind of outline his painstaking efforts to create this dictionary over the course of many, many years. I think it's published just after his 70th birthday. Explain how in this dictionary, Noah Webster actually managed to sort of sneakily advance the cause of simplified spelling with little, if any, fanfare at all.
Well, when his radical reform in 1789 didn't catch on, he withdrew from this cause spelling reform, but he didn't give up on the idea entirely. So 20 years later, when he's putting together his humongous, tremendous dictionary, even bigger than Johnson's, he selectively incorporates some of these older simplified spellings into his new book. And again, words like color and honor without the U, plow spelled P-L-O-W rather than O-U-G-H, which is how the British still spell it. The word draft spelled with an F in there instead of a G-H. And because he pushed for these more moderate spellings, and because he wove it into a much larger book, that it caught on, because once his book became widely used in schools, these spellings gained legitimacy, and they've retained that legitimacy to this day because they have come to shape what we know of as American English.
By the way, I think some of the most fascinating stuff in your book, which are relatively brief tangents, but I'm so glad they're there, are when you touch on other efforts somewhat comparable to Benjamin Franklin's to reshape the alphabet. Some of those efforts happening here in America, some back in Europe. And some of these efforts involving kind of the flipping of letters or the insertion of numerals are particularly interesting. But of course, at a glance, they don't seem like the slightest bit helpful when it comes to the matter of simplifying things. What was behind these efforts? I mean, in what way did the creators of these various sort of alternative alphabets believe they were on a path towards simplification?
Well, every reformer comes to simplified spelling with some different idea of this utopian ideal of what the alphabet and the language should look like. And for Webster, it was not adding any new letters. It was just subtracting silent letters. For Franklin, it was adding six letters and removing six letters. Then some in the 1800s, some reformers came along and they started flipping letters upside down and they started using numbers. And it really is this rainbow of human ingenuity and how many different ways you can creatively come up with to indicate 44 sounds when we only have these 26 letters. So in the 1840s, there was this man named Auguste Thibaudin who suggested replacing all vowels with numbers. And in a few years after that, there was a man named Bartolomé Banowski who suggested replacing all letters entirely with numbers. And the two of them, they drew up very similar number grids, and they had this whole complicated system that to us looks like way more of a complication of spelling. And to them was that perfect, most sensible, most essential utopian ideal of what English should look like.
When you get to the figure of Brigham Young, it is who, of course, also is one of those figures who tried to craft a new alphabet. It's so interesting to think about his purpose. Culturally, the significance that he saw in the crafting of a particular alphabet that would be distinct from that used by other Americans. And, of course, you point out quite rightly that the biggest challenge lay not in creating such an alphabet, but in persuading the community to use it. And, of course, that in and of itself was no small matter.
Right. Brigham Young in that early Mormon community is really a microcosm of the simplified spelling movement at large. So here he is at the, he's in Utah. They're a few years into their Salt Lake territory, and he's trying to improve his Mormon society by introducing a new, simpler spelling. He goes through the whole process that every reformer does. He writes up books, he writes up primers, he sends out for new metal fonts, he prints out some newspapers in his new spelling. This new alphabet he calls the Deseret alphabet. The Deseret alphabet, the word Deseret means honeybee, and it was his way of referring to the industriousness of his community, and he called the university the Deseret, University of Deseret. The Deseret News was the newspaper, and this was the Deseret alphabet. And it was complicated because it was hard to encourage teachers to use this alphabet and teach the kids. It was hard to encourage politicians and anybody who didn't want to change their language overnight because it takes that much longer to relearn how to spell all over again. So the Deseret alphabet, it existed in the Mormon community for about a decade. It eventually faded, eventually fizzled. But it is telling that even in this microcosm of the simplified spelling movement, where you do have a unified church, a centralized government, you do have one authority at the top who could, in theory, implement all these reforms and mandate them, even he wasn't able to get these through. It just shows how deep of a hole it is to dig out of English spelling and make it more sensible. It's just too clumsy for any one group to handle.
You touch at one point upon how a number of the champions of simplified spelling were part of other movements such as alcohol temperance or vegetarianism, anti-vaccination movements from way back when. It's really quite intriguing. One person I want to make sure that we at least touch on briefly is a gentleman by the name of Isaac Pitman. And this is a name probably completely unknown to most of us, but a lot of us at least are aware of what he created that is sort of an interesting phenomenon, maybe kind of adjacent to this matter of simplified spelling. Explain to our listeners what Isaac Pitman created.
Well, a lot of listeners will know, or their grandparents or will have grown up learning shorthand. This was usually Pitman shorthand if you're from Britain, or Greg shorthand if you're from America. And Pitman shorthand came about from the simplified spelling movement. And instead of removing silent letters and phoneticizing words, this was an overall an overhaul of the spelling as we know it and our alphabet. And it was made up of squiggles and lines. And basically the idea was it was a way to capture transcription at the rate of speech, so on no delay. And this was a big boon for secretaries and stenographers. And in the 1840s, 1850s, most of the people using Pitman shorthand were men, because these were the people who filled the roles of stenographers. And that started to change in the 1860s. And this stenographic role, this profession, started becoming infiltrated by women. And eventually, women and Pitman shorthand became synonymous with each other. And Pitman became this symbol of empowerment for women in the progressive movement and suffragists. And it continued into the 1900s.
I hadn't thought of shorthand in I don't know how long, but my mom, who was a secretary, was an expert at shorthand. And I remember when she would go to parent-teacher conferences, she would utilize shorthand to take down every single word that the teachers would say in these conferences. And it's so fun to be reminded of that. And also to be told, I never knew that the original name of this was soundhand. And I just love that that term. It says a lot about why it was created. Your book is peppered by all kinds of other fascinating figures. I mean, it says one thing about how extensive this history is, that all we can really say is the name of Mark Twain and sort of leave it at that. But you explore his long, wide-ranging, sort of oscillating relationship with the whole notion of simplified spelling. I want to give you a chance to talk about Theodore Roosevelt during his presidency, becoming for a relatively short time a boisterous champion of simplified spelling, in a way that ultimately proved to be, let's say, counterproductive.
Roosevelt was a huge champion of simplified spelling for about 3 months, three really long, concentrated months of radical linguistic reform. And he came to the movement through the Simplified Spelling Board, which was founded in 1906 by Andrew Carnegie, the big steel tycoon, one of the richest men in the world. And on this Simplified Spelling Board were Mark Twain, Melville Dewey, the creator of the Dewey Decimal System, William James, the philosopher and psychologist. And Roosevelt became a big fan of this board, and he pledged his loyalty to their cause. So in 1906, he directed many of his federal employees to begin using simplified spelling. The word though would be T-H-O, and the past tense of the word kiss would be K-I-S-T. Any past tense word would adopt that T instead of the E-D. And he started issuing documents and correspondence in this simplified spelling. And I think that Roosevelt, he was very reform-minded. I think he always saw himself as this leader on the cusp, on the frontier of American society, pushing us into the modern age. And simplified spelling was just that next linguistic frontier. He was trying to bring us into modernity. And but the backlash was just pure phonetic mockery. It was political cartoons. It was these exaggeratedly misspelled newspaper headlines, and the press really just had a field day with Roosevelt. And what happened was, instead of giving this movement of simplified spelling more positive visibility, his stature and his prestige ended up kind of killing the movement, because it made it a target of ridicule instead of this object of utopian ideal. So Roosevelt had a, you know, he brought simplified spelling into the highest office of the land, but he also kind of kicked it back down.
I want to finish by talking about something you explore in your book, namely the first significant national spelling bee in the United States that occurred in June 29th, 1908. So this would be during the Theodore Roosevelt administration, towards the end of his second term. And you chronicle for us the controversy that actually swirled around this event before it occurred, over this question of would it be sort of normal spelling versus simplified spelling. I mean, it's a real indication of how much of this sort of unrest was in the air. But it does, of course, eventually go forward. And you tell us about the amazing young woman who ended up being named the champion of that spelling bee, Marie Bolden. And I will give you a chance to talk about her, but also about the fact that the United States is probably the biggest country on the face of the earth when it comes to spelling bees, because in places where languages behave more normally, in a sense, you don't need spelling bees the way you need them in a place like America with this crazy quilt of a language that we all speak and write.
Right. Spelling bees are not popular in other countries for the sole reason that spelling bees need to have complicated spelling for it to justify this cutthroat competition. To have a spelling bee in Spanish or German, it might test you on your knowledge of the rules of spelling, but it's to have a national competition would be almost like having a math competition in which you're only adding single-digit numbers. It's not that competitive, and it doesn't really have the same draw as English spelling does. And this first national spelling bee in 1908 comes out of the peak of the simplified spelling movement. It's only 2 years after Roosevelt puts his hands into the movement, sticks his nose in. And at this moment in American history, the future of spelling seemed genuinely in question. So the first national spelling bee is this direct rebuttal to the simplified spelling movement. One newspaper even called it a flagrant defiance of the movement. And it was this way that the traditionalists in America, the purists, could reclaim traditional spelling as the supreme form of written English language, and to reassert its dominance over the simplified spelling forms that had been pushed by all these muckraking reformers. And you mentioned the winner of the spelling bee. So the spelling bee was won by a 13-year-old black girl from Cleveland named Marie Bolden. It was very unexpected. There were some protests at the bee. One of the teams had protested her presence there and protested that they would even have to share a stage with a black girl, and they threatened to remove themselves from the event entirely. And a lot of the press you see in the lead up to this spelling bee has to do with race and the fact that she not only did participate and that the organizers of the bee came to her defense and refused to give in to any of the threats or the protests. It's very telling. And the fact that she not only participated but won is a real shining moment for America and for the place we had just come out of only a few decades earlier.
It's just one of many fascinating stories in your wonderful book, Enough is Enough, Our Failed Attempts to Make English Easier to Spell, published by Day Street, an imprint of William Morrow. Gabe Henry, congratulations on an incredible book. I loved it. I learned so much from it, and I learned a lot from this conversation as well. Thank you so much, and best wishes.
Thank you, Gregory.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Tim Mahone and the 25th anniversary of the fund in memory of his parents. From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, tonight is the Opera Workshop at Carthage College, 7:30 p.m. in the Recital Hall, free and open to the public, with a variety of favorite arias and duets and the world premiere of a new one-act opera. 7:30 tonight in the Recital Hall at Carthage College. Partly sunny skies today and mild conditions, a high of 73 degrees. It will be a little cooler near the lake. Overnight, clear skies, overnight low of 50 degrees. Tomorrow, Wednesday, mostly sunny and a high of 63 degrees. We see Sunshine in our extended forecast. In fact, sunshine expected all the way through next Monday. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. WPR News.